as a band leader who has also previously been still, I mean, made a living as a freelancer, what is the proper etiquette in these situations as a freelance musician, a hired gun, when you whip your phone out, when you are taking Instagram stories, when you're, you know, doing this stuff, if you are the hired gun at a session?
I think you have to understand what the parameters are that set, like, what is appropriate. Can I share this song? There's a handful of people that I follow on Instagram that are actually friends of mine that it's like, hey, doing a remote session for this person. Check it out. I'm like, there's no way you cleared that with them. Like, if I were them, I'd be kind of pissed.
This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features. Annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com. What's going on? Welcome to The New Music Business. I'm your host, Ari Herstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business, the book. Today was a real treat, is a real treat, I should say. I just recorded this episode and I'm buzzing from it, but you're about to listen to this episode. It is with Corey Wong, the incomparable Corey Wong. Most people know him as the guitar player from Wolfpack. Wolfpack named one of their songs after Corey Wong when they were inviting him into the band. He inspired the name of the song, Corey Wong, and featuring the guitarist Corey Wong. But he's also played in the Late Show band, John Batiste and Stephen Colbert. He is a he was a freelancer for many, many years in Nashville. He's currently based and grew up and lives in the Twin Cities. Done the freelancer thing. He's played with Blake Shelton's record. He played on Florida Georgia Line's record. I mean, he's played with a bunch of people on the records and they probably don't even know. That's how the life of freelancing goes. We had a really great conversation. This is a longer episode than most. I encourage you to spend time with this. Listen to this all the way through. There are so many gems and nuggets in this that you're going to want to hear, especially if you're a freelancer, if you're a session cat, if you're a player or a band leader, honestly. We talk a lot about the ethics going into leading a band and payment models. And we talk about how to lead sessions and the ethics and the etiquette around how you should conduct yourself in a session when you're a freelancer and how to lead a session if you're a band leader. He tells some stories playing with Wolfpack, and how those sessions work, and you know, just being on both sides of the glass, proverbial glass or literal glass in the studio. I'm still glowing and buzzing from this, so you're gonna dig this one. You can find both Corey or myself on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok at Corey Wong, at Ari Herstand. You can find all of us that make the show at Ari's Take. Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and of course, visit aristake.com. Get on that email list. That is where you're going to get all the most up-to-date information that you're going to want in your inbox, aristake.com. All right. Oh, please like, subscribe. However you're listening to this right now, just smash that like button, that subscribe, that follow button. Up thumb it if you're listening on YouTube right now. Leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Those really, really help. Subscribe to the show if you're just discovering us now through Corey. Hi, Corey's fans. You're amazing. I saw you in the New Deco live stream a few months back. What up? Follow the show. I think you'll probably dig it. There's a lot of great episodes. I think this is maybe our 60th episode or something, season 2. All right, let's kick into the show. Corey Wong, welcome to the show.
What's happening, bro? What's happening?
This is I wore my stripes for you. I thought you were going to wear some stripes to be on brand, but my stripes are vertical.
They're vertical. You're the horizontal. And they're spaced stripes differently. Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, I'm typically horizontal, evenly spaced.
Right. I didn't have any horizontal striped shirts bring today, but you know, I felt like I could come in costume in some capacity. But so you're in Minneapolis right now, yeah?
Yeah. I'm still living in Minneapolis and just, you know, traveling a lot for work as I do.
So have you been traveling a lot lately, or when have things started to open back up? I see you got like a big tour starting in just a few weeks, but have you been gigging recently?
In October.
I misread it. You have a July date at the Iowa City Jazz Festival.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm doing Iowa City Jazz Festival, then I'm doing Newport Jazz Festival, a couple other things.
Yeah. A
couple things in the work. It's like now that it's like, oh, some restrictions are lifted, capacities are lifted. Cats are finally either pulling the trigger on their festivals that they had like kind of set to go, and now everybody's kind of figuring stuff out. So there's like things being worked out that I think I'm going to do or not.
I mean, your first leg is Europe, which is far behind where we are. How is that looking right now? It's just kind of a wait and see deal.
Well, the promoters all said, and all the local promoters, all the agents said, this is the time to put it up on sale. We have faith that it's going to be fine by the time whatever. So
yeah,
I'm hoping that it happens, obviously. I know it's going to the one thing that's going to be difficult. Sorry, I set an alarm because I was mixing something, and sometimes, you know, I get just tunnel visioned.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to miss our meeting. Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see what the different countries do as far as restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there going to be specific things that you need to do to get from country to country? Is it going to be too much of a pain to make happen?
I heard about this European vaccine passport that they're rolling out.
Okay.
And that American citizens can get when you're traveling. It's like a phone app kind of deal. That the EU will honor in all the countries. So who knows? We're still figuring it out here. I mean, we're supposed to, California is lifting, we're going to 100% capacity, I think tomorrow, actually.
Oh, really?
And our cases are super low and things are opening up. And have you played any shows in the last year with an audience?
No. Well, I just did a couple things with like a very limited. You know, mostly they've been streaming things with like, 20 people are there in this 1,000-cap venue or something.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what. It's all starting to pick up, which is great.
Yeah. How are you feeling now? How have you been feeling? I'm so curious with someone like you who spends so much time on the road and so much time performing in front of an audience to have been neglected of that for the last year and a half. What has that been like for you?
It's been tough because it's such a source of revenue for most artists. And it's a way that I can keep my band having income because... Mm-hmm. I can make albums and I can do that sort of thing, but you know, the way that my band gets paid is that I pay them work for hire for the albums.
Right.
Most of the time, pretty much all the time. And that's how they want it. You know, it's like they want to get paid to do their session work. And then they, you know, so I'll make residual income off my album. So I can make albums, write music, and still have some income, but my band does it like they just get paid for the sessions, you know, because most of them, that's just what they want.
Yeah.
And when I can go play, I myself have a source of income, but also am able to help provide a source of income for a lot of other people.
Right.
So that's kind of a bummer that's just kind of the reality of that thing.
Yeah.
And, I can't keep a band just like on salary or retainer or, you know, whatever.
You're not Prince yet. Right.
That's correct.
And
So, I mean, for me, I think it's, It's been okay because I've had some time at home to write a lot and record a lot, and that's been really creatively energizing in a different way. Mm-hmm. But I had to very early on just accept that and just be like, okay, I'm not doing concerts and I'm going to do maybe a couple streaming things, mm-hmm. but there was a lot of noise. So I just kind of wanted to stay away from some of the noise.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of musicians can relate to that. When everything shut down, Instagram live streams were just bubbling up at the top and everyone was going live and trying to frantically figure things out. And then as it settled into place, I mean, live streaming became kind of almost a nuisance, I would say, for most musicians. It's not fulfilling. It's not really fun. It's a way that some people were able to earn a little bit of revenue. But you did employ your band in some capacity over the pandemic. I want to talk about Corey and the Wong Notes because the previous 2 hours I've been doing nothing but watching the episodes, which if you're listening to this right now, pause this and go watch every episode of Corey and the Wong Notes on Corey Wong's YouTube channel. If we spend the next hour just talking about Corey and the Wong Notes, I will be completely satisfied because this is one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen from an independent musician. The production value, the writing, the acting, of course, the music, but that goes without saying. And so take me back to the beginning. Where did this come from, Corey and the Wong Notes? And then step me through how you were able to do this during the pandemic.
Yeah. I will answer that in a second, but you opened a loop in my brain that I need to close.
Okay.
saying that live streams a lot of time became a nuisance for musicians. I 100% agree. But I think one of the reasons why it seemed that way, and sometimes even for audiences, is a lot of people just kind of did throw together things and nothing felt really compelling. Mm. Well, I don't mean to say that. Most things that were streaming events, live streams, didn't feel really compelling. It felt like, oh, I need to just kind of do something, so I'm just going to kind of set up and not really think about it and do it. And it didn't feel like it had real care.
Intention.
Intentionality didn't feel like it had the same amount of care as somebody would put into an actual live show, which to some degree, of course. But also, I think that's why certain things, that environment became that. And for me, as even a consumer, it got to be where it's like, just give me something really compelling and I'm down, you know?
Yeah.
So I think for me, I didn't really do much at all. But I'm way late to the game. I just did a live stream last weekend, but I wanted to do it from a riverboat on a boat because that seemed compelling and cool, you know? And I have a thing where... I have a thing coming up at Paisley Park, you know, where it's like something unique and special. And to me, those were I didn't have those ideas or the availability to do that when COVID was rampant, I guess you could call it. So now that things are kind of half opened up, I'm able to do things that this actually feels pretty cool to me. So I want to do it.
Are you charging tickets to the Paisley live stream?
I will. I'm still figuring out what I'm going to do for that.
And did you, was the previous live stream that you did from the boat, was that ticketed?
Yes. It was on a platform called Looped.
Okay.
It was cool. I really liked the platform.
I mean, I tuned into your, the New Deco performance that you did down in Miami. New Deco, they were also guests on the show.
And that felt really compelling because that was something new and unique. And that was one where it's like, yes, I will absolutely do that one.
I mean, it's done so well. You have this full orchestra there. You're outside on a band shell. You have your band, and it's multi-cam. It's live edited. You know, it felt very live. It felt like we were right there in the performance because you were acknowledging the fire trucks that were driving by. And, you know, that was probably the best. Now, I tuned in as a consumer to a bunch of live streams just to see how people were doing it. That was probably the most entertaining live stream because it was done so well. The chat box was there.
Yeah.
There was a whole conversation happening in the chat box. People referencing, you know, you attract a lot of music geeks. And so, everyone is kind of just geeking out on various parts of the show and your musicians and they know your band and, you know, Johannes Tonu was there. And so people were calling him out. I'm like, wow, like this is impressive. But yes, I mean, that's a very high production. I think what caught a lot of musicians up early on was just like to put on a live stream that is compelling. It takes a lot of, not just a lot of money, but just a lot of know-how. Like I, you know, early on in the pandemic, I ran the Uncancelled Music Festival with a couple of friends of mine, and we put on hundreds of shows in 10 days. Mm-hmm. And like just that learning curve was extreme and intense. And like, you know, I was spending 16 hours every day trying to figure out how all this stuff worked and then training the musicians on it, on how to do it. And I feel like we almost finally got a handle on it right now when things are opening back up and no one I sure don't want to go to any more live streams personally. I'm ready for live music again. I want to be like standing next to someone sweaty, spilling their beer on me. I miss that.
Well, yeah. And it might be, I don't, when I say compelling, I don't necessarily mean high production value. I think just high artistic value. The Wolfpack fan group, Wolfpack, did their own Live from Lonely Town Festival. And that was super compelling because it had a great concept. And there was a lot of people from all around that had a common thing. And they all, you know, most of it was, like a webcam or something, which it didn't need to be high production. It was high concept and artistic, and it had community value to it. So I don't mean compelling in the sense where I expected, you know, every musician to have a great setup. I just think something that had more, I was just wanting to see more,
creativity.
Yeah, creativity and artistry in something. It's like, okay, we're going to try something new and, I don't know. We don't have to go all the way into that, but yeah.
Well, you do bring up a really good point, and I think there's a lot of takeaways from this, and I think it is an important point. If you do something differently, you excel a bit quicker and you attract a bigger audience. I mean, it's like what has attracted so many people to Wolfpack early on is that where everyone was putting together these highly produced videos, multi-cam, and kind of focusing on the sheen and the production value, Jack and Wolfpack went a different way and just did this super lo-fi, very creative, somewhat kitschy, hilarious lo-fi videos that were single cam. But it was so creative and done in a way that had such an aesthetic and intentionality that comes back to that. And it was purely artistic and it's like created this whole aesthetic based around that. And so people latched onto it.
Sure.
And I mean, you've done a very similar thing in your own way, and everything that you put out, it feels very consistent through the lens of Corey Wong. Like Corey Wong as a brand, and as just kind of this, I guess it's almost the character Corey Wong. It's like when you put on the striped shirt, you become character Corey Wong.
Absolutely.
and I think that, you know, it takes a long time for artists to understand who they are and how to be consistent. You know, when we throw around marketing terms like brand or aesthetic or all that stuff, artists' eyes start to glaze over. It's like, I just want to play music, man. It's just about the music. But it's like, but it's your voice, and it's so much. It's like, what are you saying and who you are? It all needs to be communicated in that very distinct, specific way to make sense.
Yeah. And it is about the music, but the way that you have to think, a lot of people that would say that don't necessarily consider as much or give the due consideration for the way that consumers absorb art in today's day and age and are exposed to art in today's day and age. And so much of it, because there is, I don't like to use the word noise, because there is so much stuff out there to get through, you kind of it really helps to have those other things where it's like, I don't know if the the greatest musician in the world without some sense of what their brand is. I mean, I don't know. Like, there's a way to break through it, but it would be, you'd kind of be an anomaly if you didn't have some sense of your aesthetic or whatever. I don't know. Yeah, no, I think it's just different now. Like, the way that we consume things, the way that we absorb things, the way that we are exposed to things is very different than just being able to throw on a song.
Right.
You know? Like, that's pretty rare where somebody's just like gonna all of a sudden hear your song somewhere. Like, how are they gonna get to that? Like, is there gonna be a YouTube video that gets them there? Or is it going to be a playlist? Is it going to be like, because in that case, then there is an argument for that. If it was just on, like, the music is so incredible, it landed on all these playlists that are curated by people that know exactly what kind of people want this incredible piece of art, and they might find a fan base, popularity, notoriety, whatever it is they're looking for in that. But I think it's harder nowadays.
But more times than not, the artists that don't have a strong sense of self, that put out great music, and maybe they get lucky and anointed by the Spotify playlist gods and get thrown on a bunch of playlists, oftentimes they're not actually, I know, right? It's like, please, I pray to the Spotify gods every goddamn night, and they have not blessed me. Dude. So, you know, but we're seeing these artists that do get their songs on the playlist. They're oftentimes they're not actually building a fan base. They're building streams and listeners who have no idea who they are. You know, I'll go to see shows of artists who have millions and millions and millions of streams, and often sometimes a couple million monthly listeners, and they can't sell 50 tickets to their hometown show. Yeah. And we're in this really weird place right now in the history of the music industry. That's never happened before. Like, you've never gotten a gold record and not been able to sell 50 tickets, you know, like that.
Dude, totally. Well, and then, I mean, it's like, you know, we're in such a phase of trying to figure out vanity metrics versus real world value, and then, like, what really is a vanity metric? What is real world value? Because a gold record is real world value, millions of monthly listeners is real world value, but like, the festival market is gonna pay you $1,000 for your set, you know, or like $600 to come play this festival, and you're gonna crappy slot, but you, not crappy, but like a less than ideal spot, and yet you have more streams than everybody at that festival. It's like, it's a tough thing, but also different fan bases value different things. So, like, on the other side of that, an interesting case study on the opposite side that I've noticed is a lot of really popular jam bands, cats that are pulling in $500,000 guarantees for festivals.
Right.
We'll have less Spotify action than I do, or, you know, than some of the just kind of like other mid-level artists that are out there. It's like, oh my gosh, how do you have no streaming? But their live value is so high. So, of course, we see both sides of that. But again, it's, what does that fan base cherish? What what are they in for? Like, why are they connected to this band? And it is just the live experience, or maybe it is the idea of, I just listen to these bootlegs because I don't like to listen to what everybody else in the public has to listen to this band of this band. So I've got these weird bootleg recordings that don't count as streams. So I don't know, like, there's a lot of sides to that too. That's a
I mean, you brought up vanity metrics, which I think is really important, because this is something that we all battle with, because it's kind of like, you know, the definitions of success and what does that mean? And it's like, you know, oh, you only have 100,000 Instagram followers or 10,000 Instagram followers. If you were anything, you'd have 100,000. You know, it's these numbers and these metrics. They're all vanity. And like you said, it's like, we like to make snap judgments on people's levels of success, and that's just as an industry. You know, I've literally talked to talent buyers who will say, "Oh, I won't put them on this free showcase of Los Angeles talent if they don't have at least 50,000 Spotify streams or monthly listeners." I'm like, "What? Like, but you just said like you love them and you love this music, and that's an unfortunate thing," is kind of where we're at. And yes, like it's what is the value of what you're doing and bringing in? And yes, in the jam world, and a lot of artists build it up live, and their fan base will buy tickets, and they're probably making a lot more revenue at the end of the day, real world value, real world money, than these artists that have millions of Instagram followers and, you know, hundreds of thousands of monthly listeners and all of that. And so it's like, at the end of the day, what are you really focusing on, and what do we really care about?
Yeah. That's what every artist needs to decide for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think for many of us, we're trying to have all of it, or some balance of all of it, right? Like, that's really the win. And also, like, an accurate representation of all of it, you know, like not having, like, nowadays, I actually have a friend where I called him out. I was like, "Dude, you have bots, don't you?"
Yeah.
He's like, What are you talking about?
Yeah.
I was like, "I see your Instagram, I see your numbers, and it doesn't add up. I see some of the comments on your posts, and it doesn't add up. I just want you to know that every time I see a questionable comment, and I'm thinking, is that a bot? Of course it's a bot."
Yeah.
Like, don't do that. Like, get rid of that. So that, to me, like, that's my, I maybe some people would have a different philosophy. And that one, I think it was HBO, the fake famous.
I saw that.
That was pretty interesting to watch. But anyways, like, that's, okay, whatever. I thought that was actually really cool to watch. It was interesting to see the different people's reactions to it as well.
And just for listeners, it's they take three people who are wannabe influencers, and they kind of they audition them, and then they follow these three younger 20-somethings around as they turn them into influencers. But a lot of it was buying followers, buying likes, buying comments. To kind of trick the algorithm and to trick people into thinking that they are more famous than they actually are. But they also tricked brands. And that's the most fucked up thing about the whole thing, was that people actually sent them products. They got free vacations and free trips places because they had hundreds of thousands of fake bot followers.
Yeah.
But then it's like, you take that a little bit further. It's like, okay, if you just are trying to get free vacations and free product, then if that's your end game, okay, this is a way to do it. Buy all these fake bots. But in music, I always try to remind people, it's like, and ask them, what is your end game?
Yeah.
Your end game, I'm assuming, is not free product or free vacations. I'm assuming it's a music career.
Yeah, it's
like a sustainable music career.
Yeah.
Right. So I like that you called him out. And I've started, after I watched
I'm not afraid to do it now. Any of my friends that I even remotely suspect, I'll just ask and I'll get their response. And then that immediately, like, I'll cold call them out on it just to see, you know, because I just think it's not good practice. It doesn't seem ethical for what we're doing. Well, but anyways.
I agree. Okay.
So we can go back to that. We closed loop, and then
let's close the loop, and we could go down that path for a little longer. But I'm so curious about Corey and the Wong Notes.
Yeah.
Step me through that whole process.
Okay. So years ago, I had a concept for a variety show. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought, like, a lot of people, I've been a music director for a lot of bands. I've been a music director for a lot of, like, I guess
you
variety
played on
show.
The Voice, and you played on
and like
you
things where it's like, hey, we have six artists doing a show, and we need a house band to be the music, and we need a music director to learn all these, you know, and I've done that a bunch, whatever. So, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool if there was a variety show that's like The Late Show meets SNL if the musicians took over?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I had the idea. I had the idea, but I didn't really have the full vision for it. I guess that's some vision right there. And then I came up with a full pitch. I came up with some ideas, scripts, outlines, episode themes. Uh-huh. Here's what I think it will cost. Here's what I think I can bring to the table. Here's the value that I think it has, blah, 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 this and that. I pitched it to a bunch of people, companies, platforms, whatever. Basically not one of them responded.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, screw it. I'm going to do it myself. And yes, it was expensive, but also to me, I thought of it as, okay, here's my album budget. Mm-hmm. And let's pretend I also have a music video budget.
Mm-hmm.
And I combine those two together, plus some more, yeah, because it's a little bit, the scope is higher. And that's basically what I built for my budget of it. And
tell me, can you reveal that? Can you tell me how much the budget was for the Corey and the Wong Notes series, the episode series?
It was around $100,000.
Okay. Yeah, that seems. I was actually anticipating a lot more than that.
Well, I did a lot of editing. I did a lot of writing. Wow. I mean, I did a lot of the editing, writing, mixing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, producing. You know, yeah. I did all the pre-production. Of course, I did hire people for some of those positions, but also a lot of my friends like understood what I was trying to do and what my vision was for it. So. Mm-hmm. It's not like it was the most insane rates either. You know, I was getting bro deals from a lot of my friends, and I feel like I paid people a respectable amount, but like their friend deal, right?
Sure.
And that adds up a lot, of course. And, you know, I stayed and slept on the couch at Pitar's house for, you know, a week and whatever. So, you know, like I'm okay hustling. Like I'm a worker. Yeah. I will edit the entire thing myself if I have to. I'll mix the whole thing myself if I have to.
Wow.
Fortunately, I had, you know, people to help with a lot of that. There's a great team. They're incredible. Ben Cady, the director, really helped, you know, put a team together as well on the video side. And yeah, like
where'd you do it all? Where'd you shoot it?
All the stuff on set was done in Nashville.
Oh, okay.
And the stuff, and then some of the sketches were done there, and then some sketches were done in LA. So we had a lot of COVID protocol we had to go through. It was like right when the NBA started doing their bubble thing and showing like, hey, this works. So we did a bunch of testing, pretty much masked up the whole time until the take, you know, for those that could. The crew was wearing masks the whole time. And, you know, we did it in August of 2020.
Okay.
So it was supposed to be in March. Then we pushed it to April and pushed it to June.
Huh.
Screw it. Let's wait. Let's just cancel it or postpone indefinitely. And then finally we said, okay, is everybody down if we do it this way?
Mm-hmm.
And it worked out. And it was great. So it was a huge undertaking, but also I was so driven by this vision, and beyond just the fact that it was my album budget and my music video budget and whatever extra, like I'm a save. Like I live a really modest lifestyle. So, you know, I drive a 2007 minivan and, you know, so like I will invest in my creative endeavors as a form of artistic expression way easier than I will. Way easier than I'll buy a nice car. Like I don't need a nice car, you know.
Yeah.
But also, I know that these are assets that I'm creating. The half generation. This is a sidebar. The half generation and generation above you and I, the way that they created assets for themselves or long term investments beyond the markets and whatever, is that they would buy real estate, and then okay, like one of the ways that people create wealth for themselves is they'll buy a piece of real estate. Wait 5 years, do a cash out refinance, then use that money to buy a new house. And then they'll wait 5 years and then do a cash out refinance on that house and then purchase another house you know, use that money for a down payment on another house, and then they just build equity in real estate investments. For sure. Us as artists, we can create real estate out of nowhere.
Well,
intellectual property. We can create these investments.
Sure.
These things that will hold some level of value. Of course, not guaranteed value like physical, my neighbor's house is worth mm-hmm. more than my album, that's for sure. But, mm-hmm. you know, over the course of several years, if you can create these little condos of albums, you know, it can be this thing that you continue to invest in your own career. And if your career continues to blossom and grow, it can be things that turn into a large catalog that has some value that either will continue to make you money over the course of several years, or you could sell it to somebody who's looking to buy a catalog, which I have artist friends that have done that, where they've sold their catalog for...
You mean the royalty exchange
on a same concept, you know, on an eight to depending on what we're talking about, 8 to 12x multiplier of the yearly value, mm-hmm. the average yearly value of the last 3 years of that royalty stream or whatever, and you know where it's projected to go. But
sure,
yeah, for me, making the Cory and the Wong Notes project was all of that stuff in one. But it's also, to me, I was trying to think long term. Okay, I what if I do want to actually have my own show? Like, okay, I pitched the show to a bunch of people. Nobody was interested. And now I at least have a proof of concept. So it's like, okay, here's the first season of the show. I did really short episodes just because it would cost
10 to 15
more.
Minutes.
And honestly, well, I'll tell you transparently, I just filmed a second season and the episodes are going to be way longer, but mostly because I'm going to do probably 2 songs per episode and I'm going to let the interviews be longer. That's one thing that I really wish I would have done more in the first season is just had the interviews go longer. Like that to me is,
I mean, it feels very much like a sketch comedy show. Even the interview portions.
Sure.
I mean, episode one with Cody, it seemed like that was pretty much scripted. It was almost like a bit you guys were doing.
Yeah.
But then when you did the episode with the percussionist, tell me her name again.
Nega Santos.
That seemed like a real interview. Like she was actually breaking stuff down. But the way that you kind of added your own like wongy shtick in there is you kind of had these like you were explaining what she was talking about visually on the screen through these various like beat pentameter-y
notation.
Notation, I suppose. Yeah. Right. And so that was fun. And so that done very differently than any talk show or sketch show or variety show. And yeah, it's very much geared towards musicians and all of the, a lot of the jokes most only musicians really get. And I think it's hilarious. I mean, I love the, you touch on this a few times. You do this little sketch, the instruments that never caught on.
Yeah.
And, you know, like for the first episode, or the first time you do it, you're like, it's like the smaxophone. And it's a saxophone with a little hand that's smacking her while she's playing it. Like, never caught on. Or like the plastic bagpipes and it's just squeaking. And it's like, and the trombone. I was dying.
Gotta throw the trombone players under the bus.
So tell me about the musicians in this thing, because you have some of the horn heads. Michael Nelson is part of the horn heads, right?
Yep. He is OG. The leader of it. And the horn ranger. So with that also, it's like I wanted to have a large band, and I had a vision for, you know, because all my other sessions and like the Wolfpack sessions, Fearless Flyer sessions, we record everything in the room. Camera in the room.
Yep.
You just capture it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
You just kind of can't do that, like do the recording and then mime it later. That just doesn't work.
Right.
And with this, I was thinking, you know, like you're saying, Wolfpack, it was great that Jack kind of had a vision for going the opposite of what a lot of people did, which was the slick multi-camera thing and that. And then I did a similar thing where I would do everything just iPhone in the room. And now I did want to just kind of swing the pendulum over. So we did it all on set. We recorded the album on set. I wanted to do a full live band, five-piece rhythm section. Mm-hmm. So Petar Janic, Sonny T, mm-hmm. Kevin G.
So it's just background, Sonny T, didn't he teach Prince how to play guitar back in the day? I used to see Sonny T play with the combo before your time with the combo. But yeah, I would see Sonny T play there. And I know he taught Prince guitar, but he's a bass player and a guitar player, obviously.
His history is insane that we could go an hour on. Like Sonny, you know, he's played with everybody from Prince, Nick Jonas, mm-hmm. Chaka Khan.
Yeah.
James Brown, you know, like all these, anyways. So Sonny's one of my absolute heroes. So him playing bass on it. My friend Nega Santos, I met her from playing with John Batiste on The Late Show. She's a percussionist there. Kevin Gastongue, he and I went to college together. So he and I have been playing together literally since the first day of college. Half the horn section is the horn heads. Steve Strand on trumpet one, Kenny Holman on sax, Michael Nelson on trombone and arrangements. Mm-hmm. My friend Sam Greenfield played Barry sax and bass clarinet, kind of doubled up there. Mm-hmm. Eddie Barbash, I met him also through The Late Show, alto sax. And John Lampley, I met him through The Late Show playing second trumpet. So, it's fun to have the six-piece horns, five-piece rhythm section, doing it all live in the room. Everybody's on edge at all times. Every take, everybody's like, I don't want to be the one to mess this up. Right. You know, because there's 11 of us.
Yeah.
And there's the camera team. The camera team doesn't want to mess up. The lighting director doesn't want to mess up. The band doesn't want to mess up. So everybody's on a certain level of focus that you don't get when it's just, we're doing a session at the studio all week.
Can I overdub that one line? I think it was like second chorus. I fracked a note. Let me just punch me in.
You don't get that. Right. You don't get that.
Right. How many takes did you do for each song?
At most, on average, it was two or three.
Okay.
I normally used take two or three from everything. There was the song that we did with Antoine. We just did one take.
Wow.
And it was just like, well, that was it. It's pretty rare. That's pretty rare when everybody is like, yes. Sometimes, most of the time, the rhythm section will be like, oh my gosh, that was insane. And the horn player's like, yeah, but this one section, I'm like, I don't care.
Yeah.
It was great. Yeah. Right. Or the horn section will be like, that was the best thing ever. And I'm like, I don't know. Was it? And it's like, okay, well, yeah, fine. Let's just use that take.
Did you do any overdubs?
No. Well, there was a couple spots where we did some background vocals.
Okay.
Where I added a couple background vocal things. Because that, to me, Spotify took precedence over.
So this was more a concept of you want to make a variety show. Was it always going to be around an album?
I knew in order for me to do it the way that if I was self-funding, it absolutely would have to. And it probably should, because it's also just a fun way to promote an album. It's like I made an album, but I built a show in order to promote the album. Mm-hmm. So it's just another way to build buzz, like trying to find creative ways. You know, I'm somebody who has, I guess, a fair amount of creative output. So the one thing, I totally oversaturate the average Corey Wong listener. You know, like I oversaturate the average Corey Wong fan. But in order for me to try to balance that out, it's like, well, what can I do that's compelling to make people really pay attention to this release, even for the average or not average person who's not necessarily interested? What can I do to get their attention?
Real quick, I want to let you know about Too Lost. Too Lost is a new distribution company to the space. And let me tell you, I am very impressed with them. I got a full deep dive demo with the founder. And they're very innovative. And when you come into the distribution space at this stage with how crowded it is, you better be innovative. And they are. Yes, they will get your music out to Spotify, Apple Music, all the places, plus 450 other outlets around the world. They do not take a commission. This is why 300,000 artists and labels have already used them. They've already distributed 7 million songs. they offer payment splitting, and they don't charge your collaborators for this service for the payment splitting. They will just pay your collaborators directly for free. They have publishing administration with BMG, so you know it's legit. A lot of distributors have fallen into trouble with using some other less than legit pub admin services. Well, Tulos is partnered with BMG. You know it's legit. They offer instant royalty advances. This is something that's very cool. And if you have historical streaming data and you need just a bulk payment up front, they can see how much your music has earned in the past. I'm like, all right, we think we know what you're going to earn in the next 3 years. Here's a check for $100,000 or whatever it will be. And you can just click a button and get that distributed and into your account immediately. They do lyrics and credits distribution for free. They have a very innovative analytics platform where, yes, you will see real-time analytics for Spotify, Apple Music, but also Pandora, Deezer, SoundCloud, and Peloton. They're the only ones that do Peloton. They also have a service where you can search the internet wherever your music is being used, and it will just show you a chart of everywhere, every TikTok video, everywhere, every YouTube video, everywhere your music is possibly being used. I've never seen this before. That was very cool. They'll register you with SoundExchange, and they have a fraud prevention tool, and they're doing fraud prevention. So if you're worried about your music, you know, getting a bot attack or something like that and getting ripped down, which we've seen is a big issue. They have fraud prevention tools that are better than most other distributors that I have seen. Check out Tulost. You can just go to tulost.com, use the promo code ARISTAKE for 3 months free and try them out. Let them know what you think. I mean, the constant stream of content that you released through the pandemic, especially early on with the videos that you were just continually pumping out. I remember mm-hmm. seeing a YouTube comment of somebody expressing her appreciation that you kept putting music out when everyone else was shell-shocked by the whole situation. Like, thank yeah. you for continuing to release music and for, like, giving me something during this when there is nothing for all of us right now. And yeah. so I think a lot of your fans do appreciate that. But it takes a lot of work and a lot of energy. And, I mean, just doing the music itself is a lot. But the fact that you have so much content and, I mean, with this variety show, with the Wong Notes, it – you know, it makes sense because you cut it all up and you popped a few of the sketches on your IGTV. You're able to put some sure. of the sketches yeah, standalone. Yeah. Some of the, you know, the songs obviously are going to Spotify. So it was like you kind of batched a whole year's worth of content more or less yeah. into the session. So that was a nice way to bang it all out. But do you have a content calendar? Do you have a schedule where it's like, okay, I want to do this, this, and this. I need to do IGTVs, YouTube videos, reels, music. Let's get this out. Schedule it out.
I personally, well, first off, thank you. I personally don't. It's all based on projects that I'm working on or things that I'm interested in doing. Mm-hmm. So for me, It's based around an album and an album cycle.
Okay.
You know, in a similar way where people would go 5 years ago, say, or 10 years ago, write the album, record the album, release the album, tour in support of the album, mm-hmm. push some radio, do radio promo, some social media promo, whatever. You know, that's part of the album cycle. For me,
right.
I visualize part of the album cycle being the social media that's happening around that time, maybe sometimes doing a few things to grease the algorithm before mm-hmm. I put out an album. But also I don't love just constant, like, check out my album.
Yeah.
Because I think I'm a little more self-conscious that, like, I don't want to overdo it for my fans. I don't want to keep asking them to buy stuff. Like, I don't want mm-hmm. to feel like they're constantly being sold something. So yep. The only time that I really build in that sort of thing is just like, okay, I'm going to be putting out an album soon. So I'm going to have a single and then another single and then the album and then some stuff doing that. So in between some of those things, I'll put out something that's just me playing guitar or something where there is no call to action. There's no there's no ask involved. It's just something, you know, that I think they might want to see. Like, people follow my page probably because of one of these three or four reasons. Let me just give them something with no responsibility attached to them, no call to action, just something that might be a bullseye of what they're looking for on why they follow me. So that's the only time that I really schedule anything, but I just do it when I feel the energy to do that, you know?
But these, yeah, like,
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, your IGTVs, that almost standalone. I mean, I was and the way that Instagram does it now, where you can just watch a thing and it just plays the next one. Like, I would just kept on going with, and it seems people really love these. I mean, some of these are getting quite a significant number of views. I mean, have you trained your ears lately? Video 75,000 views, and that's hilariously. I mean, you know, the guy who got caught at the office printing tabs or copying tabs on the office printer, and they're chastising him for that. And then, like, Judge Corey, all of that. And so these aren't even musical performances. These are all the sketches from the Wong notes and other things here. And so, I mean, you have very little music actually on the IGTV. So step me through just kind of the process behind how you figure out what content is going where.
Well, that's unintentional on the IGTV side. IGTV just is basically anything that's over a minute long that's on Instagram to me. So I try to keep everything 59 seconds or less on Instagram. Because also, I just don't get a lot of action on Instagram TV compared to just regular Instagram posts. I don't know if there's an algorithm thing there, but I know the number of views on IGTV videos and the engagement on IGTV is way lower than just regular posts. So with that, it's literally just like those videos needed to be more than a minute in order to paint the entire picture for that. Where it's like, oh, the guitar videos, I can paint the picture in less than a minute. You know, and if you want more of it, like, listen to my record or check out the YouTube video. So for me, that's kind of my only thought with that. As far
Yeah, I was going to ask you exactly that. You were about to say TikTok.
Yeah, as far as that, it's like, I don't know. Like, it's kind of a fun, silly platform. And it's a different pace. The app is paced differently. People, your voice needs to be different on TikTok. Your voice needs to be different on all of the social media platforms, in my opinion. Because people interact differently on those. The pace of those apps is different. The way people interact, the general demeanor of people in the room, and by the room I mean those apps, it's different. And to me, like, I was messing around on TikTok for a couple weeks, and then I posted on there a handful of times, and I got some action on there, and then I was like, oh, I'm busy recording my album, so I'm not posting on there. And, you know, people around me are like, dude, you're recording your album. Like, you got to be doing this. It's like, yeah, well, I, even people in the band, it's like, you were thinking about your TikTok. I was thinking about making the album.
Right.
You know, like, I needed I needed a certain level of focus to make the album.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about a lot more things than the drum take, you know, not to single out the drummer or anything, but. What I'm saying is, like, I will do it when I feel energized to do it, and I'm not keeping up with the pace of the app, and I'm not smashing it on TikTok, where I probably, in some ways, like, could be smashing a lot more if I kept up, even just literally on pace alone.
Right.
Somebody can, like, if you know what people are following you for, and you stick with the natural flow of traffic on the app, you're bound to grow. Like, I should probably post more literally on every platform. But I have something compelling to say every day on Instagram.
And that's, there's this quote ironically, Dan Wilson tweeted years back. He's like, how many great songs have we lost because the songwriter decided to tweet their inspiration instead of channel it into a song? I'm paraphrasing.
Sure.
But it's that idea of just like, if we harness that elusive, magical inspiration, not even just minutes in the day, but we're talking like the magic when that hits or that comes or is funneled or you're in the groove, and you take to TikTok or you take to Twitter instead of taking to the studio or to the record or to the song, you know, it's going to change your trajectory, but also it may actually diminish what your creative output that's long lasting could be, because TikTok, Instagram, this is all fleeting. That's not like, you know, you could get a TikTok that gets millions of views, and people do this every day, and it comes and goes, and that's fleeting. It's like, okay, and then what? But if you make a song, that'll live on for generations. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what are your real intentions of doing all of this?
Yeah, and like you asked earlier, what's your end game? You know, I think people, and those things aren't mutually exclusive either. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you can definitely have those things, but I think it's understanding when is the right time. Like I sometimes get frustrated with people in the band that might be paying more attention to like, oh, let me get this good video in this moment. Where I'm like, dude, there's literally like cameras everywhere. They're filming everything that we're doing.
Right.
There's going to be a good video.
Right.
But also like, I'm not upset because everybody's like got their, like, it's not distracting them enough where it's going to prevent them to do their job. But if I were doing it, it would distract me enough to do my job. And
well,
that's not to say that I have,
you.
Well, it, to a certain extent, but I'm not distracted only when it is somebody like getting in my face. Oh, like, what are you doing on this? I'm like, dude, I got to think through this thing.
Yeah.
Like I'm thinking about which camera angle to start, how to reveal who's in what part of what shot. And I have to play my guitar in time and in tune and in the pocket and remember all the songs.
Right.
And I'm thinking about how the arrangement works together, how the rhythm section coincides with the horn section, and be the producer and the guitar player at the same time. You know, if something is distracting me, it really distracts me.
Yeah.
Because it distracts like all four or five positions that I'm holding at the time.
Mm.
But it's also okay. Like some people, they're going to crush the take every time, and it's not actually as big of a distraction as it would be if I were doing it, you know. And that's okay. Mm. Like, and also some people's ability to just turn it on and turn it off is different. I feel like I have a pretty good sense of being able to do that, but in certain senses, in certain situations, I just can't have that distraction. Like, most of my friends and family were pissed at me a week and a half ago when I was filming Corey and the Wong Notes season 2. I just didn't have my phone with me at all during the day, like literally at all. The phone was on the other end of the room, and I got to the place at 8 a.m. and I left at 7 p.m. and I didn't touch my phone, you know? So it's like, yeah, I didn't text you back.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but like, I needed to be in this headspace. And then afterwards I was thinking about all the stuff. So it's like, I ended up with a pile of unread messages and, you know, and whatever, like that's part of the deal. And, sure I could make like an out of office auto reply, but I've actually never done that, but I don't know. There's just a balance, and everybody's different on what they can do to keep up with, to stay energized and not get jaded on it, and also not to distract them from what their real artistic pursuit and vision is. It's different for everybody.
Totally. So as a band leader who has also previously been still, I mean, made a living as a freelancer. Mm-hmm. What is the proper etiquette in these situations as a freelance musician, a hired gun, when you whip your phone out, when you are taking Instagram stories, when you're, you know, doing this stuff, if you are the hired gun at a session?
I think you have to understand what the parameters are that set, like, what is appropriate. Can I share this song? There's a handful of people that I follow on Instagram that are actually friends of mine that it's like, hey, doing a remote session for this person, check it out. I'm like, there's right. no way you cleared that with them. Like, if I were them, yeah. I'd be kind of pissed.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So for me, the first season of The Corium and the Wong Notes, I said, nobody post a thing. Take all the videos you want, pictures you want, wait till it's out. I want it to be a huge surprise when it yes. happens. This time around, I said, new season, I don't care. Post whatever you want. The guests that are going to be on it, post from the studio. I honestly don't care. So I set that parameter on the previous season and the freedom this next season, or this one that we just shot. Mm-hmm. And I just tried to make sure that communication was clear. I think the expectation is, yeah, don't reveal any like songs that we're doing. Mm-hmm. Don't give away any spoilers on hearing the music. Or just follow the leader. Like if the leader is posting this sort of clip from this sort of thing, okay, well then that might be appropriate for you to do. But if the leader is not posting clips of their new songs, you probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, that's my thought. Like if I'm playing for somebody else's, if I'm doing a session for somebody, I'm super stoked about it.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll just post a picture from the session. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, whatever. In the studio with John Batiste and John Bellion, we're having a blast. You know, and that's what I did. I felt like that was appropriate because they had also posted pictures from the studio. No videos, no spoilers, whatever. Just like we're hanging out in the studio. Mm-hmm. As far as my band, yeah, it's fine. And just like, don't do something where it's distracting in the moment when we're actually doing something that matters. Mm-hmm. Like if we're just sound checking or we're messing around, tuning up, or, you know, in between, like, okay, we got this song done. Now we're just kind of setting up and reblocking for the next tune. People are kind of messing around. Yeah, that seems like an appropriate time to be able to do something or whatever. But don't play something super loud and disruptive, like when other people are working, sort of thing. Like trying to figure something
it's
out.
Like that kind of. It's the etiquette. It's the freelancer etiquette. It's like, yeah. If you're the drummer or you're the guitarist, it's like you don't. You shouldn't be ripping when you're kind of getting set up and people are trying to, you know, get the sounds for the other instruments or whatever. It's just you kind of inherently get to know that etiquette. But I think we're in this new era of social media. And like personally, as a band leader as well, when I'm leading a band and I'm in studio or something, I mean, that I like that you lay the expectations out. Sure. But it like it frustrates the hell out of me. But that's a pet peeve of mine that I don't I feel like if you're taking your stories, Instagram stories, while we're in studio and we're in between takes, like you're not focusing on what the next take is going to be, or you're not focusing on that riff you missed in bar 32, or you're not, you know, and it's like you're out of that. And it's like, that's why I like turning most notifications off, because if you're focused on working on a project and you keep getting yanked in every which direction, you're going to just, you lose your focus and it takes a few beats to get back into it. And so if we're in it together and we're starting to flow and you break that flow by whipping out your phone and doing whatever, I mean, if you're hired for that session, like that is frustrating. And I would caution any musician out there just to like, yeah, like you said, follow the leader, but also, I don't know, maybe ask the leader as well.
Totally.
Like,
yeah.
Right?
Totally. That's the easiest way to figure it out.
Right.
You touched on something that I've been adamant about for years. It's sometimes hard with a large band. So like I said, the band is an 11-piece band. Mm-hmm. Everybody is absolutely assassins on their instruments. Incredible musicians. And everybody's trying to impress each other, play musical jokes, funny, trying to get little laughs, whatever. The one thing that sometimes bothers me with the band, with being such a large band, there's a lot of people to distract and a lot of people to be distracted. Mm-hmm. The one thing that really bothers me on sessions in general, it's not just my band. I love my band. I put up with a fair amount of this, but sure. If there's one nitpicky thing I could say, please stop doing this, which they'll have to watch this to hear. No, I'll tell them. I've had this conversation, but it just sticks sometimes and doesn't. Yeah. Like if you're recording a ballad between takes 2 and 3, don't start dicking around and playing something that's totally out of the vibe. Because right. then it all of a sudden, oh, now this person's out of the ballad vibe. And now I'm out of the ballad vibe.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, like, I'm in this, like we were just playing a ballad and you're literally like dicking around playing a Metallica song.
Yeah.
It's like, I love Metallica and I love Metallica songs, but like now time it's just not place. The time. Now is not the time to do this. I just need, or, you know, some, theme song from the 1950s or something. It's like, oh, it gets some laughs because like I said a word and then it's like somebody played a riff that has to do with that word. It's like funny. I gotta give them credit.
Yeah,
it's great, it's clever, but it like now everybody it's gonna take an extra minute to get back. So mm-hmm. sometimes there's some of those little etiquette things, but the bigger mm-hmm. etiquette things you've pretty much addressed, and that sort of stuff I go through that as a session musician a lot of times, like, okay, what can I do? I think a lot of times you just need to think a service mindset. What can I do to absolutely get this artist's vision across in the most efficient, fastest, and best way possible, and the most artistic way possible? Mm. So most of the time that doesn't involve my phone. Right. You know, like,
yeah,
if I
yeah.
were to think of the ideal scenario while we're in focus mode, what probably doesn't exist in that ideal?
Mm.
It's maybe some of that stuff. But mm-hmm. Again, when you're not in focus mode, it's totally fine and it's mm-hmm. different. But I think, yeah, communication with the artist, producer, that sort of thing. I've shown up at sessions and be like, hey, should I just keep my phone away for this whole thing? Like, oh, no. Like, you can mess around. Like, we're going to be messing with stuff and we can punch in and, mm-hmm. You know, like, whatever. I'm like, oh, okay, fine.
Where are you at these days in your career with what sessions you take? Mm-hmm. Is it always discussed that you're going to be a feature? This is going to be featuring Corey Wong, or are you still taking sessions as just the faceless guitar player like you used to do?
Totally. Everything in between.
Okay.
So if somebody's asked me to play on something, normally it's pretty clear if they want it to be a feature, mm-hmm. but I have managers now and they just kind of handle those conversations. And it's a different rate, rightfully so, if I'm a feature on something, or sometimes it'll be a percentage of the back end or something, or mm-hmm. or a combination of the two. But I do also just love doing session work because mm-hmm. that's part of who I am as a musician. That's what I like mm-hmm. doing also. So sometimes I'll just do session work for people, whether it be somebody I know or not, you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my friends, I'll literally just play on my friends' albums and not really care about the money side.
Yeah.
Shouldn't say it's that. I shouldn't say that publicly, but but then also it's like, I don't know. I don't know this person. My rate's kind of high for you, I think. And then they might be like, oh no. Like, I'm a pharmacist,
mm-hmm.
and I actually invented the medicine and totally overcharge. So doesn't matter what your price is. And I'm like, oh, okay, great.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I'm glad you revealed that up front.
And sometimes, and honestly, like I'm not a famous person. Like I'm niche. Mm-hmm. I'm well known niche wise, maybe. But so also, I can't expect that everybody really knows who I am. Like somebody recommended me to be the session guitar player for this great session, and the mm-hmm. pharmacist guy. And his wife, they were doing it was his album, and she was the bass player, but she was kind of featured on some stuff. I don't know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
he was just like, hey, we want you to come play guitar. And they didn't know who I was as far as like a brand or whatever. And I don't always expect people to, you know, it's, that's absurd. So they had a great budget and that was nice. But it's also like compared to talking to Lukather and Larry Carlton and stuff, like what we're making now on Sessions is not even remotely what cats were making in other eras, mostly because of union sessions and residuals and some of that sort of stuff. It's like, dang, these cats, you know, you understand why a lot of those old cats are jaded. Not all of them, of course, of course.
Yeah.
But then other times, like, you know, somebody will call me and the singer says, hey, I just recently, this girl said, hey, I love the way you play guitar. I don't have a lot of money, but I think you might be perfect for this track. And here's this song or whatever. They emailed my manager. My manager said, hey, you know, normally, you know, this is below your rate or whatever. And she literally can't afford it. What do you want us to do? I said, oh, well, just I want to hear the song. Mm-hmm. I thought she was incredible. Great, great artist. I said, yeah, whatever. Like, I love the song. I really believe in what she's doing. I think she's wonderful. If this is like something that she thinks will absolutely make her song crush 100% or more of what she wants, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And granted, you know, if I really like the song and believe in the artist, you'll do a lot. Oh, yep. you have a great article on the hang, the money, the artistry.
Yeah, I was going to say it's the perfect 30, I call it. And it's like it's this equation, and it's money. So each category is worth 10 points, and it's the money, it's the enjoyment and career development, and it's kind of when you add up the points for each of them, they should equal at least a 15. Yeah. And if they're below a 15, so you know, if the enjoyment's 10 but the money is a little bit low, it's like a 2 or a 3, and the career development's like 2 or 3, it's like, all right, we'll take it, it's like 15, but it's like enjoyment's gonna be like a 2, that money better be a 10, you know.
Well, I'm familiar.
You remember that? All right
No, yeah. and that's, I mean, that's I didn't remember exactly what the scoring system was, but I think that's something. You know, in most areas of life, I think some people, in professional settings, people can apply that sort of thing. Not just.
I'm curious about, you mentioned this at the very beginning, when your pay structure for your musicians, for your freelancers, you're saying it's a work for hire and that's what they want. Correct me if I'm wrong. With Wolfpack, doesn't Jack just kind of cut everybody into the back end of whoever plays on the track, and just like whatever that track makes, whether you played percussion on it, whether you're the singer, or whether you're whomever singing background, you're all getting cut on the back end. I'd never heard any record done that way before.
It's amazing.
So tell me, step me through the just. Because I think you're independent. You can do whatever you want. You're a band leader. You make the rules. What's the thought process in going how to pay your musicians based on where you've come from, what you've experienced, and why you chose this route?
The structure is a lot different, and the expectation is a lot different on my situation as opposed to Wolfpack. You're absolutely right in what you've heard. For example, like if anybody who played on the Beautiful Game album is an equal cut for the royalties. So Bethany, who played trombone on one of the songs, makes the say on Aunt Leslie, Aunt Leslie, how are you? Depending on what part of the country you're from. She makes the exact same amount of money as I do, or Joe Dart, or Jack, from those royalties. It's pretty cool. Jack's just made that, like, Chris Thiele makes the same amount of money as any of us for the Live at Madison Square Garden album, because he played on the album. You know, he guested on the song. And yeah, that's how Jack does it. It works great. It's a band format. None of us are expected to be paid up front. And, you know, each person puts in a different level of work, and that's totally fine. Like, I think, I guess in some cases, some people are paid up front and then it's, you know, recouped and then whatever. Like some people that aren't. Like,
well, when you got these older session cats, like
Like Gadson or
James Gadson or right, okay. I was wondering about him. I see him on a track. I'm like, okay, this is Bill Withers, former drummer, and he's played with everybody and has been around the block, and he's probably in his 80s at this point, 70s, 80s. It's like, is he going to understand the back end situation thing? But
And totally. And if people want to have some sense of balance, like that's what we did with the Fearless Flyers albums. Mm. Like we just paid ourselves $3,000 each for the session.
Okay.
And then we're all in equal split afterwards. Mm. So it's like Wolf Records, we had some album budget, you know? And like, so for the last Fearless Flyers album, I produced the album, put the budget together, went through it with Jack. It was just like, all right, let's just pay everybody $3,000 up front. Mm-hmm. And then we'll all split the royalty on the back end evenly. You know, like I don't make any more as producer. Jack doesn't make any more as mixing engineer and I guess co-producing also. And doing the videos and stuff and doing all the social media and setting all that stuff up. It just works. Like all of us live a pretty modest lifestyle, you know, and yeah, so that works that way. As far as the way that I do things, I don't think, you know, if I'm going to spend, you know, so for me, if with my band, what do I cut the percentage on? If I'm doing it similar, like, okay, everybody's going to make an equal cut of the album after expenses. I don't know. Does everybody in the band trust my gut on the expenses? And it's not actually like also a band thing. It's Corey Wong. So it's, you know, I have a lot more to lose. I have a lot more to gain. It's a little bit different, you know? So I've considered making that.
And you're making the investment up front. You're like, paying for everything.
And of course, like I would recoup and then people would make their royalties. But you know how hard it is to make $100,000 back on an album today? Exactly what I'm saying. And most people who listen to your podcasts and follow you in general, they're in the industry. They understand. So, also, side note, you got to be my sync guy. That's what I need. I need you. I need the Ari's Take team to just be my sync team.
All right. Well, we'll
how
talk.
About that? I made $0.
Oh my gosh. Oh, I could get you a sync agent in a heartbeat if you really want to do some sync. Dude. I'm like literally talking to sync agents every day right now because of our sync course. Where that's our big thing is we're putting people like
make me your case study. Day.
Okay.
from zero to hero in 1 year with Ari's Take.
deal.
So that's the thing. Like if I had a great sync, that would help solve all of this. But again, like I'm not necessarily trying to play checkers with this entire thing. I know it's not just like one move is one move. So with the album and the videos, like, and you know, being able to, so I vinyl, and then it also gets people more excited about the live show, so I will be able to sell more tickets because like people can see this show live and there's a more of a sense of that. But then also like, oh yeah, next time, like if they give John Krasinski or whatever the next late show or the late show for his Some Good News show that CBS maybe bought or something, or some network bought it, it's like does he need a band? Well, who should be the band leader? I don't know. It's not like the type of gig you audition for, but this in some ways it's like an audition tape. You know, it's one way for me to have a little bit of that to play some chess. Mm. You know, it's somewhat of an audition reel for a lot of different things beyond just being an asset on its own, beyond the biggest thing, which is just an artistic expression, this creative idea that I had that I wanted to bring to life. I know that it's not just that sort of thing. So that's the other reason why it's like, if it were a percentage thing, I don't know. My band just wants to get paid for their week of work.
So I was having this conversation with a bass player. He's in Nashville, and you know, he's a freelancer, and he's linked up. I'll call him. I mean, he'd be happy. Nick Bearden, he's the bassist for Jamestown Revival. And, you know, we were talking about this, and it's like almost an ethical conversation when it's like, you know, I was these musicians who, sure, they're employed when the band is on tour and they're doing really well. And some of them, you know, are making six figures when the band is touring. And then the band stops touring for years and years and years, and they can live off their record royalties. And now these musicians are almost back to square one, struggling. Is it fair that they're not getting cut in on the success of the record? Maybe a guitar riff made the song, you know, what it is, and that's the thing that everybody is singing along to, and that guitar player made a few hundred bucks for the session, and that's it, and they're never getting compensated again. And now they're struggling. They're in their 50s, they're in their 60s, and they're struggling to get by. I don't know. I mean, it's not typically done that way, but I wonder if it should be more than just the 5% what they'll make on the digital radio royalties from the fund, from the SAG-AFTRA AFM fund. You know, I've thought about implementing 20% of all master royalties are split amongst the musicians who played on the session. Mm-hmm. And if anything, after recoupment, after expenses are recouped. And if it turns into anything, they you know, join in the success of it, and oftentimes the records don't recoup, and that's fine. But and they get paid for the session up front as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't have the answer, but I don't know if it's fair that Taylor Swift is a multi-millionaire and her drummer you know, is going to be scraping by if she doesn't bring him on tour. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's but you are the man in charge who can make these decisions, and yeah. I'm not advocating one way or another. I think it's an interesting conversation, and as someone who has been a freelancer and now a band leader, I'm curious your thought process.
So my thought process in that is that I just don't have anything right now. If I'm being completely honest, I'm not making crap tons of money on my albums.
Sure.
So, I mean, do the math. I mean, anybody who can pull up a Spotify calculator and my entire catalog, and right. then kind of like retrograde that, or whatever the right word is, across mm-hmm. all the streaming platforms by popularity, mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, you know, Apple Music is like 80% of what Spotify is, and Tidal's like 30%, and
yeah,
whatever is 3% of that. Like, sure. expand however you want to do the math.
Right.
It's just not enticing for my band. Like, I don't have anything enticing. That would be a way better deal for me right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, okay, so how many streams?
No, a both deal. It would be both.
Yeah,
be
yeah.
Like,
okay, yeah. A both paid, deal would be, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, for the session. And then if the song turns into a massive hit that generations to come
are
playing, then you, this is your retirement. This is your kid's, you know, nest egg, more or less.
Yeah, totally.
But
so a both and, that totally would work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what I've thought about doing is just trying to find what the right number could be. If it's like, okay, full transparency to the band. Here's the budget on the album.
Yep.
Here's what everybody's getting paid.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
And you can either get paid your session rate, or if I and my managers are projecting correctly, here's where that break-even point would probably be.
Mm.
And here's at this percent or at this percent or whatever. Mm-hmm. You have the choice to either get your session fee or to have 3% of the album
mm-hmm.
royalties.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, I own the master, but you get 3% of whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I like your idea of having 20% get split between the band.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think for artists, they need to find some sort of incentive, aka mm-hmm. no upfront on that side of it. Or I don't know what it is. Like, it's hard enough to like, dude, I'm literally driving an old car.
Right.
In order to, like, everybody's like, why do you have, like, my mirror is taped on the car. Not that it has to be. Like, I just don't really, we all value different things. I have no sob story to tell here.
Yeah.
But I'm using my, like, yeah, I don't know. I just.
Well, and I'm not saying that, that's the argument of just, because if not now, when? Because it's like, okay, when you're making, because some people would look at you and be like, well, you're making way more than me and this person. So it's like, it's all the different levels. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, okay, you're not making millions on your royalties a year. That's very clear. But like when you are, is that when you flip the switch and have that conversation, or do you have that conversation now? And then is it, you know, because unfortunately where we're at is just, you know, most superstars, most stars, most label artists that have a massive budget and their session cats, their players aren't cut in. I mean, if they're a label artist, they can't really be because that's just not how the label system works for them. You know, producers are cut in, and maybe a mixing engineer will get a couple points on that or something. But it's mostly just the artist and the producer. When you're cutting in players, but it's a different thing because you are the label. You're an independent artist, and
yeah, I can decide that. Yeah,
you can decide that however you want, and we all have to decide that. So there's no right answer. It's just something to, you know, totally. It's like the conversations to think about. How do we want to structure this as the label?
Yeah. Great question.
I don't expect you to come up with your answer.
No, totally. I think it's just something that, like, yeah, we could. I think it's important for artists to think about. Like, for some mm-hmm. of the larger, like, I played on a Blake Shelton album. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know it. He couldn't care less. You know, like, he doesn't know that I played on his own. I played on a Florida Georgia Line song. Nobody would have expected me to play on their album, and they couldn't care less that it's me. You know, that $800 or whatever it was nice, mm-hmm. right, and I'm totally content with that. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know. So I go back and forth with that. I think in some degree, it's like a lot of artists have to consider so many different things. For me, I want to make sure at least right now people feel like they're really taken care of. Mm. And, you know, I think with some things, you put such an investment into them, you want to have every possible way that it's going to recoup in the next 5 years or whatever, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know. And great. Like, what I think it's okay for people to talk about. Like, I'm totally fine talking about any numbers with my career.
Sure.
I don't mind doing that. I think it's actually important
that
people know. Like, I think there could be misconception on both sides of it. People think I'm making billions of dollars, and people thinking that I'm making nothing.
Yeah,
you know. So,
I appreciate your candor and transparency with the numbers, and I think everybody appreciates that because so many people are very guarded with that, and it's helpful to know and to hear the thought process behind it. This has been incredible. It just like went. It sped by so quickly. We're way over time. I'm going to ask you my final question that I ask everybody who comes on the show, and we're going to cut it there. And I have like 50 other questions that I never got to, but this was a great conversation.
We'll do
a part two. Fantastic. What does it mean to you to make it in the new music business?
It means that I can live out what I feel is my true calling in life in a way that's artistically satisfying, but also a way that validates art as a career, and in the sense of making it, it's really nice to be able to help support other people's calling as well, to be able to help other people financially, like having a band that I can pay regularly, having, you know, even the crew and the managers, you know, you know, people that are made to do a specific thing, for me to be able to help facilitate that, it's pretty incredible, you know? And what it means to make it, I don't know what it is nowadays, but what it means for me, as far as like that interpretation of it, it's it means the world, because there is a lot of there's the trope of the starving artist, and then there's the trope of the insanely rich and famous artist, and often the in between doesn't get talked about, and there's such a dynamic range of that in between. That it's nice to be part of that in between, you know. I remember freaking making $50 per gig for 7 years straight.
Yeah,
and now, and you know what? I felt like I was making it just as much as I feel like I'm making it now.
Wow!
Because it's never really been about. It's never been all about the money side of things. Mm-hmm. Granted, I've grown and I've had more responsibility, and now I have children, and I have more, more that is asked of me, you know, more than is required of me, in financial burden or whatever. Basically, being responsible for other human beings. but you know, that being said, it's always, you know, like I don't know. I think everybody's idea of what it means to make it. Like what it takes to make it, what the threshold is of making it, and what it means to somebody personally making it. Those are all three different things. So in an objective way, I totally have made it. And that's incredible. Like, you know, part of me is like, oh, no, I haven't made it. You know, it's like, no. I have objectively made it. You know, like there's no doubt about it. I've had a successful music career, and I, you know, every big long-term decision that I make is so I can continue to have that. And I'm absolutely grateful, blessed with that. So now it's being a good steward of it.
Corey Wong, wise words. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This is great.
Thanks for having me. We'll do it again. The 49 other questions you have, I will answer.
Let's do it.
And we'll hang. It's always fun to hang with you.
So it is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features. Annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com.